thing about prior off not applying.
I'll call the Committee on Health and Human Service Policy to order. We do not have a quorum, so we will begin our first testimony on House File 1049. Representative Cantrell. The chair moves that House File. Oh, can't move it because we don't have a quorum. So why don't you just present your bill and tell us a little bit about it.
Sounds good, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for the opportunity and members to testify before you today. I'm presenting House File 1049, which establishes a mobile food shelf grant program to work towards addressing the epidemic of hunger and food inaccessibility in our state. This hits particularly close to home for me. I have many friends who rely on these mobile food shelves in order to get their next meal. And at the elementary school where I once attended in my district, right up the street from where I live, there's a mobile food shelf that students rely on. And to me, this is something that is really a matter of our values as a state. When we don't allow children to go hungry, when we don't let folks who are putting their best feet forward go without food, because it's hard for someone to succeed, and it's especially hard for our children to succeed if they don't know where their next meal is going to come from. So, Madam Chair, with that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Peter Whitek, Government Relations with Hunger Solutions, Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. So House File 1049 is a bill that would renew the grant that the legislature appropriated in 2015. That previous funding was very successful at helping food shelves reach people that experience barriers to getting to their local food bricks and mortar food shelf. It helped 35 grants expand and start up mobile food shelf programs across the state and distribute over 3 million pounds of food to over 190,000 individuals, 40% of which were seniors. These are people who would not otherwise be able to make it to their food shelf due to health, mobility, transportation barriers, folks who are homebound, don't have a car or the means to access the food that they need. So this grant helped food shelves be able to purchase and retrofit vehicles to distribute food out of. Others were able to expand to different locations throughout their community. And mobile food shelves are able to quickly adjust and respond to changing community needs. For example, during the recent federal government shutdown, the Open Door Mobile Pantry quickly set up distributions for federal workers who were furloughed during that time. And the Chisholm Mobile Food Shelf was able to help out the community of Cook when their town's only grocery store burned down this last year. An additional 22 organizations have applied and were not funded for this grant. And since then, we've heard from several others around the state about the need to expand mobile food shelves. With an aging population, those needs will just continue to grow. Many Minnesotans with limited fixed incomes, low-wage jobs, continue to struggle to put food on the table, and mobile food shelves are there to answer the call for many seniors and others experiencing these barriers. So this bill would help food shelves reach people by appropriating $250,000 a year to help start up new programs and $250,000 a year to help sustain the existing mobile food shelf network. So renewing this grant means we're able to reach many more Minnesotans in need throughout the state and alleviate hunger for those who are experiencing barriers to getting to their nearby food shelf. So we encourage your support for the bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Before our next testifier begins, we have a quorum. So I'd like to have a motion to move the minutes for March 12th.
So moved.
Okay. Chair Liebling moves the approval of the minutes for March 12th. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails in the minutes for Tuesday, March the 12th, are approved. Okay, so why don't we continue with this second testifier. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Will do. I'm Jason Viana, the Executive Director of the Open Door. We're a hunger relief organization in Dakota County. And I thank you, Madam Chair and representatives, for the time today. The Open Door makes fresh and healthy food available to more than 6,000 people in Dakota County every month. We started our mobile food shelf in 2012, and that was due in great part to feedback from the community that appreciated our fresh and healthy food, but let us know how many people couldn't get to it. And we started with 4 sites in 2012, and we have now grown to more than 20 sites across West Central Dakota County, where we make fresh and healthy food available to anyone that needs it. We are the only mobile food shelf in Dakota County, and we have a waiting list of senior centers, schools, and low-income communities that have asked us, can you come? Can you come and help for us? Because, I mean, hunger, as I'm sure is not news to this committee, is an issue across Minnesota, but in the suburbs and in rural Minnesota, there's a specific challenge for access to food that's there, and that has to do with transportation, income, and mobility, and that's where our mobile food shelf and other mobile food shelves are able to be proactive and innovative in making sure that everyone in our community has access to this food. And so if you haven't already, I encourage you to spend time in your district with your constituents in senior living facilities. Go to an elementary school and talk to the social workers, especially if you have a low-income school, and ask them about the challenges, and you'll hear stories similar to one I'd like to share with you. We opened up our largest mobile distribution site at a senior living facility in Apple Valley. It's a subsidized unit with 50 residents. We set up the first day, and a woman came up to me, and I'll call her Eleanor, with tears in her eyes. And she said, I have known about the Open Door for 2 years, and I'm so thankful that you have milk and egg and meat and things that we can't afford. But you know what? I'm one of the only people in this building that has a car. And every month I would come to the Open Door, and I had to pick which of my friends I brought with me. She said, young man, do you know how hard it is to pick which of your friends eats? I said, no, ma'am. But she was thrilled. She said, today, all of my friends get to eat. And at that site, once a month, we've served more than 50 senior citizens every month. And as you know, by demographics, in Dakota County specifically, the number of seniors are going to multiply by 141% in the next 15 years. So unfortunately, we do not expect the need to decline. So I thank you for your time, and I ask each of you for your support for this bill, not only for the dignity of those in our community, but for their health and well-being. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Pantrea, you have any other testifiers?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on House File 1049? Members, any questions? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Cantrell, for bringing this forward. I've served on the board of my church's food shelf for 10 or 11 years now. I've forgotten, and my family volunteers there regularly, and the lack of access is huge. We have many families that carpool, or we as volunteers will drive them home with all their bags. They might get there on foot, but then they can't possibly bring things home, and so I really understand this, and I think, you know, it's a wonderful program, and you know, I'd like to see it even grow greater, but thank you for bringing this forward. And I do think focusing on seniors, that's the population I think that really, I mean, many populations need it, but there's such a need in that community, especially with illness issues and lack of mobility. So thank you very much.
All right. Any further questions? There being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion at House File 1049. Do you recommend it for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 1049 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
All right, our next bill is House File 1898, Representative Hassan. So the chair moves that House File 1898 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have the bill before the committee. Representative Hassan, welcome to the committee. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I just realized that I am freshman, and this is the first time that I'm showing up at this committee, and I did not bring any treats. So I apologize.
Madam Chair.
I have to say that a lot. It was
Madam
just
Chair,
put
I
on my conscious mind.
The bill. That's non-debatable.
All right, members of the committee and Madam Chair, House File 1898 is relating to creating a public awareness campaign on the health dangers of skin lightening creams containing mercury, and it's appropriating money to Department of Health to do public health awareness on this issue. Just to touch on the what skin lightening does to you, and I have testifiers here that are experts on this field. I'm not a public health expert. A lot of what we're talking about is not products. Many of the products that are made in the U.S. don't contain that much mercury, but many of the products that are shipped from either Africa or Asia contain higher doses of mercury that could harm your kidneys, that could give you skin cancer. And this is a very lucrative business, and it's a growing industry that people are using every day. I know it's very common in the African community, and it's also common in the Asian community and many other communities of color. So today I have we have Amira Dawe, who is a public health expert and who has been doing awareness on this issue many years.
So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and who you're with and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, a member of the committee. My name is Amira Adawi. I'm a public health practitioner and the director of the Beautiful Project. I have been working on this issue for the last 8 years. It's a huge issue that's impacting many communities of color, particularly women and children. Women are using multiple products. Today in this bill we're only addressing mercury, but they also mix with hydroquinone, which is a cancer-causing chemical that was banned in European countries and Canada, but it's allowed in the U.S. And now you can find from the Walgreens or even Walmart 4% of hydroquinone. So they mix that with mercury and topical steroids, which are medication, but they use it to fasten in terms of changing their skin color. So they're getting multiple exposure. Women are using during pregnancy and breastfeeding, and imagine that, how that impacts the child's brain. That impacts them even their early childhood in terms of healthy development and learning. And so we're talking about multiple public health exposure, and we need to establish this as a public health issue, just like how we address lead. When families go to clinics, the physicians talk about all the time lead. We also need to have physicians talk about mercury and skin lighting, but also public health officials. So this bill will help the system, the county, the health department, and communities working together collectively to address this issue. So please support this bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Jessica Nelson.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the chance to present today. My name is Jessica Nelson. I am an epidemiologist and the director of a program at the Minnesota Department of Health that's called Minnesota Biomonitoring Chemicals and People. And we do projects that test people from different communities in our state. We're checking to see if the levels differ between groups or over time or by location. And then we use the information to promote public health actions that can reduce exposure to harmful chemicals. So I'm going to be talking briefly today about a recent study that we did that considered the issue of mercury and the use of skin lightening creams. I'm sorry, my slides aren't working. The study is called MINFEET, which stands for Minnesota Family Environmental Exposure Tracking. And what MINFEET did was to measure actually three different heavy metals, so mercury, lead, and cadmium, in pregnant women and babies from the Twin Cities area. We actually had over 400 women involved in this part of our study. The study was done in partnership with the Health Partners Institute and with Minnesota Community Care, which used to be Westside Community Health Services. And the study included women who were Asian, East African, Latina, and white. We included women from those groups because we were concerned that some of them might be having higher exposures to mercury specifically. All women who were in the study agreed to participate, they gave informed consent, and they agreed basically that we could, when they came in to give birth to their baby, that we could take a small amount of their urine and also a little bit of the umbilical cord blood from their baby. And this was a state-funded study, and it was done with guidance from a legislatively mandated scientific advisory panel that guides our program. So I wanted to briefly say, and Amira mentioned this too, but what is the concern about mercury in skin lightening creams? So this type of mercury can damage kidneys, it can affect the nervous system, it can cause pain and rashes, and we are particularly concerned about exposures to developing babies, to pregnant women, to children and infants, because exposures during those critical life stages is so important and so sensitive. Mercury that's in these products can't be seen, felt, smelled, or tasted. It often is not listed on the label. They are not legal for sale in the United States, but we know they're used fairly widely. And anecdotally, we know that they're used more in some communities, but we really didn't know if mercury was getting into people's bodies, especially not women's bodies, and that's what biomonitoring can tell us. So the very short summary of the findings from our MinFeet study about mercury and skin lightening creams were, first, we found that women in the study who said that they had ever used a skin lightening product in the past, at any time in the past, had more mercury in their urine than women who did not. This was especially true for Asian and East African women. And then second, in our study, we found 9 women who had high levels of mercury in their urine. And so for these women, we did special follow-up to work with the woman and her family to try to figure out where is this exposure coming from, how can we reduce the exposure. And when we thought that the exposure might be from a skin lightening product, this included offering a home visit to the family. There's actually a handheld detector, it's about this big, that can check for mercury contamination in the air. So as a result of this follow-up with these elevated cases, we found that for most of them, using a skin lightening product was the reason that they had high mercury in their urine. And in one case in particular, we found that just opening the lid off a jar of one of these creams was enough to max out that machine. The mercury concentration in the air had risen so much just from opening the lid of a jar. And that's mercury that's getting into the air that the whole family might be breathing, so it's not necessarily just the woman who's using the cream. This particular cream was stored in a bedroom where children slept, where other people spent time. Sort of in summary, we're very happy to share with you a community report that we've written on these and other findings from MinFeet. We can do that after we share this information with the participants in our study, which we always do first, but we're doing that next week. And then our hope is really that families, healthcare providers, communities, health agencies, policymakers can use this information to shape policies to protect women and children. And MinFeet did give us some important information about some groups of women that might be more impacted by these practices. So focusing efforts on women who don't speak English or who were not born in the United States are important. And then just finally to mention that our program is currently doing some planning work to try to continue with this urine mercury testing, working with some community clinics. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you, and we look forward to the report.
Okay, thank you.
That would be helpful. Selma Ali. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Selma Ali, and I am a junior at the University of Minnesota, and I'm also a volunteer with the Beauty Well Project. This is an issue that is very close to home for me. I have friends and family members and people around me who use these skin bleaching products because that they believe that the Western beauty standard does not have space to include dark skin. They believe that their skin is not beautiful and they'll do anything to change their complexion. You know, seeing them experiment with these products is heartbreaking. It's self-destructive, and the type of beauty that they're trying to obtain is unobtainable. I believe that skin bleaching is impacting them psychologically, and that the type of public awareness that this grant will allow will bring them to see that there is beauty in dark skin and work against them wanting to use these products in the first place. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1898? Any discussion from members? Okay, Chair Liebling, you're representative.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wondered if, I don't know if Representative Hassan knows this, but are these products actually legal products in the in this country, or are people just bringing these from elsewhere? Kind of, I mean, it's hard for me to believe that we that the FDA or I don't know if the FDA who regulates this, but that we allow these chemicals in these products.
Representative Hassan,
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, no, these products are not legal products in the U.S. They are products that are sold in ethnic stores. And most of them don't even have a label. It says lightening cream, or it will just help you get rid of dark spots. There's no ingredient listed on it. It's not products that are legal in the U.S., no.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, that was a perfect segue. I was going to ask that same question. And as a follow-up, do you know, Representative Hassan, if anything is being done? And I guess I don't know if it's illegal to import them or simply to sell them. But do you know if anything's being done to crack down on the sale of these products as well?
I'll phone a friend on that one, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Mercury, it's illegal, Madam Chair, Representative, mercury is illegal, but people still find ways to import. FDA is trying to regulate that, but we have retailers who are selling online too, even if you regulate the importing ones. Like Amazon and eBay are still selling, and we issued a press release last year in November to address that. So FDA is trying to address that. But that's only mercury. Hydroquinone is legal in this country. So now if you go to Walmart or Walgreens, you can find 4% of hydroquinone, which is toxic, a chemical that was banned in Europe and Canada. But it's legal in the U.S. And so now Senator Feinstein in California introduced the bill last week to address that issue, not only the skin lighting but other personal care products that have toxic chemicals.
Thank you.
Do we have someone else who would like to testify?
Yes, Madam Chair. We have an expert who can speak on this issue.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and who you're with and proceed.
Yep. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is James Kelly. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health, and we've worked on this particular issue around mercury and skin creams for a number of years as well. With regards to these products, it is illegal to import or sell products that contain mercury, but there are several ways that the mercury can either be added to these products, either overseas or even potentially when it reaches the United States. There's still ways to obtain elemental mercury to mix with these products in order to make them more effective. So it can be difficult to detect and stop them at different places. We do work with our fellow agencies, the state agencies, MPCA, other federal agencies, so that if we become aware that these products are out there, to try to get them out of the marketplace, that's one tool we have. I think with this particular bill, what we're talking about is trying to get at the other end of the issue, which is the around the demand for the products, and try to educate people about the potential harms that come from using these products, which we're very concerned about. But it's been a difficult question to tackle through enforcement alone on the actual products themselves.
Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Kelly, before you leave, so it's been kind of a domino effect, and one of the questions that I was going to raise was raised by Representative Liebling, and then we went to Representative New, and she covered everything. But from, and I guess, Madam Chair, just a question for you in terms of where this bill will be traveling next. Will one of its stops be in commerce? Do you know?
Representative Albright, it's going to go to Ways and Means, and then from there, Ways and Means will make a decision on the next path.
I would think, based upon the testimony of Mr. Kelly and also Representative Hassan and her, as far as Commerce, certainly would want to have a review of this. And Representative Liebling, I know you serve on Commerce. Would you concur with that?
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, actually, I don't serve on Commerce, Representative Albright, but I guess I would just disagree that this needs to go to Commerce. I think this is a health bill. It's about an awareness campaign for women. It is not about pulling these products off the shelves or anything like that, although that obviously there's some, you know, we're having a little bit of discussion about that just to understand the issue, but I don't think this impacts Commerce at all or would be within their jurisdiction. I think that it's on its way to Health and Human Services Finance to see if we can fund the grant. That's kind of where we're at.
Madam Chair, then, and this may be for the author of the bill or maybe for Mr. Kelly, but I'm just astounded that these products would still be available. I mean, to your point about that they are actually adding mercury after the fact of receiving it in their stores, and that's why I bring the point up about asking if Commerce would, because that is the transaction of business, and they're altering a product for the resale that is harmful to the people that are unfortunately believe that it is important. So, and my colleague to my right says it's as a preservative, but he also says it acts as an accelerant for the whitening itself. So are these products known by name, or how are they packaged, or I understand it's cultural, but are they known as certain types, or what's the process, if you could just help me understand how this goes about?
Mr. Kelly, maybe? Oh, Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative. There's a number of questions there. The majority of the products that would have mercury in it would not be labeled products that you would generally buy at pharmacies and other things. Typically, they would be found at ethnic markets where they're sold in smaller quantities and often might be in unlabeled bottles. It could be anywhere from where that cream originated from, whether it was overseas or domestically, that the mercury could have been added to that. Mercury, while it's difficult to obtain, there are still avenues to obtain it through the Internet and other back channels, for instance. So it's difficult to answer with one statement. It's not usually large amounts of this material. It's small amounts. It's produced kind of as needed and then sold almost under the table in a certain way to folks who are interested in looking for those particular products. So it's not something that's been effectively been able to tackle by FDA, although we inform FDA so that they can be on the lookout for materials if we find them locally in other jurisdictions. So we're trying to bring more national attention to this question as well, but it's been challenging because of the nature of the way these products seem to be getting their way into the marketplace.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It almost sounds like it's a compounding at the point of sale. Would that be true?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's certainly one way that it could occur. It's just hard to say if the products are coming from overseas exactly where that actions might be taking place.
Yeah. Thank you.
So for this bill, you know, what we do know is that education is really important, right? And I just want to thank Ms. Adawi and the department for seeing the need for this, so much like tobacco, right? Once people are educated and informed about the harm it does not only to them but particularly their baby, it has a different result of whether you're going to use it or not. So just want to thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Hassan. Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, this is just kind of asked in the context of has the outcomes of this, I would imagine this has been going on for a period of time. This isn't something that's new. Have we seen public health impacts that go beyond the study? The study's a fairly small sample. We're talking about you know, I think it was 9 out of 400 individuals that have these high levels. And then anecdotally, I think the term that the testifier used was most of the 9 had we could kind of track that to the skin cream. And I guess it's such a small that's such a small percentage of a percentage, and I'm just kind of trying to wrap my head around if we've had any trackable health consequences that we're able to identify in the public health arena from this being something that's been, because of course it's not going to happen overnight. It's, I would imagine, decades later that those conditions would emerge as a concern.
Mr. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think there may have been a slight misunderstanding. While the overall number of participants in the entire study was in the hundreds, the proportion of those who tested positive for mercury were a much larger percentage of those who were in the East African community. So it's more confined to certain elements of the population. That's where our concerns are really coming from, and I think it's the nature of the bill. The amount and the percentage of the population from East Africa and other populations who tested positive for mercury was much higher. I think it's important to keep that in mind as we move ahead. And I apologize, but I'm forgetting the second half of your question.
Madam Chair, just the longstanding exposures and whether or not there's been public health, trackable public health outcomes from that.
Madam Chair, Representative, as I said in my presentation earlier, we need to establish this issue as a public health. This is the biomonitoring study was the starting point. And so we need to invest more in this issue to study what are these chemicals in this state, and then also study other issues that they're causing. But it's well established other parts of the world, like Tanzania, other countries in Africa and Asia, that people develop neurological issues. Some people develop diabetic because this mercury impacts the endocrine system. And so that's well established other parts of the world. But in Minnesota, we need to invest more, both education and research, to learn more about how it's impacting people.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill itself does not narrow this to East African populations. The bill itself is just a much broader range. And again, we're in policy, so I really just think the issue should be brought up here in this policy committee, and this is the only time I'll see this bill. So I really think or would encourage the author to maybe more narrowly focus maybe the Department of Health will have that ability to more narrowly focus this. But again, the study that was quoted was, I believe, 400 people, and I certainly understand the population being massed within a specific subset of that group. But again, I think if we have a public health crisis, we should definitely put the resources towards where the damage is occurring and where the health outcomes can be most dramatically impacted to a positive outcome. Madam Chair, that's all. Not really a question.
But thank you.
Would encourage
that. And I think the work that Department of Health has been doing and know the target population, but this has been very educational for me too, who have like East African friends and others that I can also share this information with. So there being no further discussion.
I'll be very quick, Madam Chair. I apologize. And just to the representative's point he was just making, it does say ethnic communities, and this may change. So I don't know why we would want to restrict it. I think that it's written very well, and I think the Department of Health is able to interpret it in a way that they can best address this issue.
And Madam Chair, just for the record, this study may have focused on the East African, but the skin lightening cream use is, widely in communities of color, Asia, all African, communities, some of the Latino community. So it's not an issue that's specific to East African. So that's why we wouldn't limit this to East African, and we use ethnic communities.
Thank you so much. There been no further discussion? The chair renews her motion that House File 1898 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 1898 is recommended for re-referral.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. All right. Next, House File 1388, Representative Hornstein. All right, so the chair is going to move your bill for you. I move that House File 1388 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have the bill before the committee. Representative Hornstein, welcome to the committee, and please present your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. It's good to be here. It's good to take a little bit of a detour from the Transportation Committee this week.
Chair Hornstein.
There, you like that. It's healthy. It's healthy for me. Healthy for me to take the detour. So, members, House File 1388's purpose is to improve access to Minnesota's health care coverage program for low-income Minnesotans living with HIV/AIDS. And the problem that this bill is addressing relates to a gap that currently exists between federal AIDS drug assistance programs and our state program that results in some people not receiving coverage for the insurance premiums and drug copays. And so, in summary, the bill updates eligibility requirements in the AIDS drug assistance program to align with the Affordable Care Act and Minnesota's expansion of Medicaid. Secondly, it addresses gaps in coverage for the purchase of health insurance and prescription drugs. And finally, the bill meets compliance with federal requirements for full coverage of prescription copays. And so the results of this for the folks that will benefit is that this will increase the number of people living with HIV who are enrolled in health insurance. 22% of individuals utilizing AIDS Drug Assistance Program are currently uninsured. It's a very high number. And secondly, it will increase the number of people living with HIV in Minnesota that are retained in care and virally suppressed. So the bill is budget neutral. It reallocates federal grant dollars without the need for additional funding. So, you know, I can quickly go over. There's three short subdivisions. Number one, it modifies the drug assistance program to include the cost sharing and modernizes the program to align with Affordable Care Act premium assistance. Subdivision two, it changes program eligibility requirements to align the program with income and program requirements in the ACA and the federal Ryan White Care Act. As you know, that was the initial federal program. Named after the teenager in Indiana who very courageously was able to enroll in school and fight for people with AIDS. And then finally, it deletes obsolete language. So with that, I have several testifiers, and the committee has questions that can direct those to our witnesses.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. Matt?
Matt Toberon will be our first witness.
All right, thank you. Introduce yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Toberon, he and his, Director of Public Policy for Just Us Health. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of House File 1388. This bill modernizes Minnesota's AIDS Drug Assistance Program. This is an incredibly successful program that provides insurance and medication assistance for low-income people living with HIV in our state. Despite the success of the program, there are still individuals who fall through the cracks. And by modernizing language and closer aligning the program to the ACA, we can close gaps and improve healthcare access for people struggling to pay for their care and medications. The bill updates eligibility requirements to align with the ACA and Medicaid expansion. It addresses gaps in coverage for the purchase of health insurance and prescription drugs and meets compliance with federal requirements for full coverage of prescription copays. Without these changes, the lowest income folks living with HIV are forced to choose between food, housing, or their medications. By keeping people healthy and on medications, we know that it is impossible to transmit HIV to others. The proposed changes will modify spending in existing funding streams and will not add any additional costs to the general fund. And we appreciate your support for this bill and for increasing the ability to keep people living with HIV healthy and reducing the transmission of new HIV infections. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And Charles Scott. Hi. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello. My name is Charles Scott. And I've been residing in Minnesota since 2016. I moved here from Texas pursuing my PhD. I'm an HIV positive male, and when I moved my care from Texas to here, they immediately put me on, because I took my care to Positive Care Clinic of Hennepin County's HMC, and they put me on Minnesota Care, which I'm still on to this day. With my hours at work being shortened, it's hard for me to be able to come up with the money for the prescription medications I have to get, you know, to maintain my health. And, you know, in order to stay healthy and continue to live. With that being said, sometimes I have to choose between being short on my rent, missing a meal or two, being short on a car note or whatever, mispaying a bill or something like that because of the copays I have to pay because of my being on the Minnesota Care. Then, you know, on top of that, I've just now been diagnosed with cancer, so another $20 on top of what I was already paying for my HIV meds is a lot. I'm paying now $51.35 for all my medications. And it's hard. Like I said, my hours, I was working full-time. Now I'm down to almost like only $20 hours a week. And that's kind of hitting me where I'm in my pockets. So me personally, I'm in support of this bill because it will help struggling adults like me take a load off their shoulders, knowing we can get our meds without having to worry about coming out of pocket or worrying where that money's going to come from to pay for our medications while being on this Minnesota Care. That's all I have to say, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony and sharing your story with us. I appreciate it. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1388? Members, you have any questions? Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Hornstein, for this bill. Interestingly, this is an issue that I have not paid as close of attention to in recent years because of the effectiveness of HIV drugs. The people in my life who live with this live quite lovely lives because of the medications available. So I think this is really, really important. But because of that, Mr. Topier, and my question first is to you. Did I hear you correctly that you said that because of the effectiveness of these drugs, it's impossible to transmit HIV to others? Did I hear that correctly?
Madam Chair, Representative New, that's an incredibly exciting development in HIV care and prevention. And our state health department is one of the states that has come out to endorse what's called undetectable equals untransmittable, which means that the medications today are so effective that when taken regularly and with proper medical care, that the HIV virus is at such a low level in the blood that it's undetectable, which means when it's that low, it's also been proven to be impossible to actually infect someone else with HIV. So when we look at ending HIV in Minnesota, we know that if we can get everyone living with HIV in care and on medications, that we can sort of close the loop on new infections.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's amazing. And in fact, the people I know living with HIV now do have a zero viral load or an undetectable viral load. So that's a really big deal. I had not heard that. I guess my only other question to you, Representative Hornstein, I'm just wondering if you know if offhand or perhaps nonpartisan staff, the difference between the current eligibility requirements and how those eligibility requirements will shift by switching to those who can be included under the Ryan White HIV and AIDS Act.
Representative Hornstein.
Madam Chair, Representative New, I think I'll have Mr. Toburin respond if that's okay.
Mr. Turin.
Madam Chair and Representative New, and there are staff here from the Department of Human Services who can talk in more depth of that, but it's expanding copay assistance, which current statute doesn't permit this program to provide copay assistance for people on Minnesota healthcare programs, and a number of changes with the ACA, including the expansion of Medicaid and the creation of Minnesota Care. This program was designed in the 90s before any of these changes, and so part of this is sort of because of the ACA, it's been great in that more people are now on public health care programs, but it meant that there's some gaps in the way that this program was created and that sort of don't interact perfectly with the Affordable Care Act.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think that stuff is spelled out in what is covered. I'm wondering about the eligibility requirements and how those change with this legislation.
Mr. Tobin, or do we need someone from DHS?
Madam Chair, I could just respond briefly, and you just in the original statute, the federal poverty guideline to be qualified for this program was written in statute at 300%, and this is changing that so it can match the 400% of the Affordable Care Act.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. There being no further discussion, the chair renews a motion that House File 1388 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those all opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 1388 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay, we're going to go to House File 1542, Representative Richardson. The chair moves that House File 1542 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have the bill before the committee. Representative Richardson, I understand you have an author's amendment, and the chair would like to entertain a motion for the DE1 author's amendment. Representative Pinto moves the DE1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
The motion prevails. All opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Richardson, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1542, as amended, establishes a shelter-linked youth mental health grant, and the program is designed to provide mental health services to homeless youth and also those that have been sexually exploited. The model proposed is an integrated care approach akin to the school-linked mental health model, allowing for the co-location of mental health services to better support youth with some of the highest needs in our state. In order to be eligible for the shelter-linked grants, the housing providers must demonstrate that they have received targeted trauma training focused on sexual exploitation and adolescents experiencing homelessness. Providers must also demonstrate the capacity to serve this population, and the language requires evaluation and reporting as well. The bill also requires DHS in consultation with MDH and Public Safety to report to the legislature with recommendations on providing homeless youth with access to birth records and to Minnesota identification cards at no cost. Youth that are homeless face barriers to obtaining these vital documents, and they are essential for accessing not only housing services, but employment and healthcare as well. Additionally, the bill appropriates funds in fiscal year 20 and 21 from the general fund to DHS to support the full continuum of services under the existing Homeless Youth Act. And this also requires giving priority to funding activities related to providing mobile case management and housing for young families. And this appropriation would be added to the base. Wilder research estimates that on any given night that there are 6,000 youth who are homeless on their own. And we know that homeless youth need and deserve a safe place to stay. And we also recognize that it takes a village and that these youth need the support of caring adults in order to help them achieve safety and well-being. At the request of a number of legislators, homeless youth service providers developed the white paper, which I believe is in your packet today. And it identifies some of the root causes and also highlights some of the community-based responses and strategies that can be used to better address homelessness. This bill is one of the strategies to address the complexity of serving homeless youth. Providers statewide are concerned about the lack of resources for youth who are homeless while parenting. Young vulnerable families require specific supports, not only to gain parenting skills, but also to work towards establishing stability. Mobile case management was also identified as an innovative area to target. There have been many lessons learned over the years in terms of addressing this crisis. There are studies and experiences that point to the effectiveness of street outreach, drop-in centers, and prioritizing housing as well. The continuum of services provided through the Homeless Youth Act are designed to meet youth where they are, and the engagement is focused on building supportive, caring, and wraparound service networks with the goals of achieving safety, stability, and hope. I have a few testifiers who are here with me today that are willing to share their experiences and would like to start with Ms. Nicole Mills, if that's acceptable, Madam Chair.
Yes, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nicole Mills. I'm the Executive Director at Oasis for Youth, where we serve young adults experiencing homelessness and housing instability in Bloomington, Richfield, and Edina. I'm also here representing the Youth Services Network, where we're a statewide effort to advocate for the Homeless Youth Act and the Safe Harbors Bill. As was mentioned, we have no real way of knowing exactly how many youth are experiencing homelessness in our state. We estimate about 6,000 on any given night. What I do know is that at Oasis last year, we served 431 youth. And in our Bloomington Public School District, we had 247 students that were identified as homeless. And that was just in Bloomington. What I can tell you is that all of our young people are deserving of support. I've worked in this field for almost 20 years, and every day I get to see the benefits of the Homeless Youth Act. Just yesterday, as I was thinking about what to say at this hearing committee, one of my favorites, and I know we're not supposed to have favorites, but sometimes we do, came by. Her name is Tracy. And I think Tracy's story really exemplifies the critical supports that the Homeless Youth Act provides and the ongoing supports that young people need on their journeys. 3 years ago, Tracy was a senior in Bloomington Public High School experiencing homelessness with her father. She would explain that on super cold nights, they would go to the airport and sleep on the benches and sort of act like they were waiting for loved ones to arrive. Or they would stay in their car in a suburban park and ride. Finally, with the permission from her father, we were able to find a transitional living program for Tracy, where she was able to graduate high school. After high school, she was interested in photography, so we found her a full-time job at Life Touch Images in Edina. Since then, she's moved out of her transitional living program. She's staying on an apartment with friends by campus. And yesterday when she was coming by to talk to her team at Oasis, she was coming in to get help to apply for college. Tracy is interested in a creative writing degree. She's an excellent, excellent writer. And without your investment in the Homeless Youth Act, I don't know where Tracy would be. I don't know where any of our youth would be without the critical supports of the Homeless Youth Act. I don't know where they'd go in Bloomington, across the metro, and especially statewide. I told Tracy that I was coming here today. And with her writing expertise, she wanted me to send this note to you. She said, "I wouldn't be where I am today without support. I owe all of you many thanks for giving me a reason to hope when homelessness had stripped it away." Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Katrina Gentina Henry, please introduce yourself for the record and give us the correct pronunciation of your name.
Okay. Madam Chair and respected committee members, my name is Katrina Henry. My pronouns are she, her, and they, them. I'm a youth board member at the Bridge for Youth. I was homeless from Easter 2017 to March 2018. Throughout my time being homeless, I felt very ashamed, but today I fight to end the stigma around homelessness. I was homeless because I wanted to escape from my toxic environment. I went to Hope Street Shelter, Youth at Hope Street. Can only stay for 3 months at a time, so I stayed until my time was up, couch top for a few weeks, and returned for another 3 months. After Hope Street, I couch top for a few days, and then I was accepted into Hope's home in Eden Prairie, where I resided for 3 to 5 months. They made me feel loved, but it wasn't a home. After my stay, I went to Brooklyn Avenues. Although I was provided with food and a shelter over my head, it still wasn't a home. Through a phone call from the case manager at Rita's house, I was offered a home. Rita's House is an affordable housing program for youth, founded by the Bridge for Youth. I read his house, the rent is affordable, and utilities are included. I'm independent, but the staff provide me with a great support system. While being homeless, I never felt super unsafe, and I wasn't out on the street. Thanks to youth shelters, I was just searching for stability, and at Rita's house, I found it. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your story.
Yeah.
Karen Kingsley.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Karen Kingsley. I'm the Senior Director of Youth Services at Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. Really excited to be here today. Lutheran Social Service, with our youth services, we serve more than 3,000 youth experiencing homelessness across the state. We operate street outreach, shelters, transitional living, and life skills programs in Brainerd, Virginia, Duluth, Cloquet, Wilmer, Rochester, Mankato, and the Twin Cities. From these sites, we serve young people in 30 counties. We're really grateful to Representative Olson and Representative Richardson for the support of the shelter-linked mental health innovation to meet the really significant needs of youth who've experienced homelessness and sexual exploitation. You've already heard some testimony on the overall investment in homeless youth services, and I wanted to speak specifically about the amendment on shelter-linked mental health. The youth that we work with at LSS and the other members of the Youth Services Network have experienced significant trauma. Many of the young people have been sexually exploited or have traded sex for a safe place to sleep. The situations of abuse and neglect that led to their homelessness, as well as the trauma of experiencing homelessness, result in many of the young people having extremely significant mental health needs. Most of the young people we work with are distrustful of systems and most adults, which is a significant barrier to accessing mental health services they need. A key component of our work is really rebuilding that trust with the youth and creating the positive relationships that can help them transition to a successful adulthood. And we've had difficulty with youth following through on referrals to external mental health resources because they don't have that trusting relationship. Having the mental health resources in the place where the youth are staying would be really life-changing for many of the youth experiencing homelessness. One story that I'll tell you is about Maggie, who was 17 when she arrived at the Reach drop-in center in Mankato that LSS operates. Her father was incarcerated, and her mother decided to leave the state, leaving her homeless and couch hopping. Her home life had been unstable most of her life, with her mom struggling with her own mental health issues. Maggie visits the drop-in center several times a week and has built really close working relationships with our outreach staff. But only after we've built that relationship were we able to refer her to mental health services, which she has been doing for the last 6 months. This has been helping her reduce her anxiety and really have a more positive outlook on life. She's getting her GED, she has a part-time job, and she's looking for an apartment that she can rent once she turns 18. So we see this as a huge success. We're very excited about this shelter-linked mental health model because it could help many youth like Maggie. It's based off the school-linked mental health model where we're seeing a lot of positive results. It would allow for the co-location of mental health staff in our services, and we really see it as a missing link. The issues that young people are coming to us with are really challenging, and we know that if we have mental health services on site, they can access them, that we can help sustain those services as they move into the community, and we can help the youth services staff really understand the mental health issues and use the expertise of mental health staff on site to really engage youth in meeting their goals. So we think this innovation will really be something that can help result in the best outcomes for young people. Thanks for hearing my testimony.
Yes, thank you so much for being here today. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 1542? Members have any questions? Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I'd like to say to Kachina, thank you for coming to testify today. I appreciate hearing what you've been through and how things have worked out for you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. To Representative Richardson, thank you for bringing the bill forward. I want to say, echo what's been somewhat said earlier on the shelter-based mental health. I work for Avenues for Homeless Youth where for the last 12 years. One of the things I've seen over the last 12 years is the amount of youth who have got mental health issues that are coming in. And initially, when I first started working there 12 years ago, we weren't able to afford any mental health support services. We ran into the same thing. we'd make appointments, youth would never be able to get there on a regular basis. Slowly over time, we've added some, but it's not as much as we need. There is a lot more demand for the services than we have staffing to be able to do it. And I can see where this makes a big difference in youth becoming more stable and supported as they go forward. So this is a great bill. I'm glad you're doing it. Thank you to the test pilots for being here, and look forward to this becoming funded in the next step.
All right. Thank you. So there have been no further discussion. The chair renews the motion that House File 1542, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 1542, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you so much. Okay, Representative Richardson, why we have you here? We're going to move to House File 1658. The chair moves that House File 1658 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. The bill is before the committee. Representative Richardson, welcome back to the committee again. All right. But go ahead, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1658 would expand liability insurance coverage for licensed foster home providers. Serving in the legislature from time to time, we get the privilege to bring forward bills that are very personal to our experiences and our journeys, and this bill is one today. I was raised in a large family with four brothers and three sisters, and even though my parents were outnumbered, they opened up their hearts and their homes to a number of foster children over the years. They were licensed foster care providers, but they also provided relative care and kinship care for more children than I can count, often doing so at great financial expense. This tradition has been passed down to my siblings. I've been a foster parent, as well as most of my brothers and sisters as well. Although all the children that my parents took in had experienced pretty significant trauma in their lives, many had experienced horrific physical or sexual abuse. In addition, being removed from their homes also caused trauma as well, as they were pulled away from everything that was familiar to them, so there was significant early adversity. We saw children with complex and significant medical needs, kids with significant disabilities, where the symptoms of their disabilities or the impact of trauma were often confused with behavioral issues. Some of the children with the highest levels of need came to us with histories of damage to property. With the level of complex care needs increasing, both counties and private foster care agencies are facing challenges in the recruitment and retention of foster families. With this reality in mind, this bill would remove a restriction. It would extend the state's property liability insurance coverage to property owned by an individual foster home provider where damage is intentionally caused by a person over 12 years of age. This policy already covers DHS, tribal governments, and corrections, and would just extend it to individual foster home providers as well. This bill would also increase the maximum amount of money the state provides as compensation for damage or destruction of property caused by or sustained by a foster child or adult from $250 per occurrence to $1,000 per occurrence. Here to share more with you is a current foster parent, Ms. Latanza Douglas.
Good afternoon, Madam
Welcome to
Chair.
The committee. Why don't you introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and other committee members. My name is Latanza Douglas, and I have been a foster parent for 20 going on 21 years, and I am honored to speak before you today. I did not choose foster care. Foster care chose me. I say that because as a younger woman, I never dreamed or imagined myself being a foster parent. After all, it was considered a thankless job, a job that many are forced into due to circumstances beyond their control. However, I chose to stay. When I was asked to speak, I didn't hesitate to say yes, because most of the time our voices are seldom heard, and randomly do we get an opportunity to advocate on behalf of ourselves. I say this because we are still referred to and described with the adjective just and only, just a foster parent. That's how they say it. Then when describing an unfortunate event that happened in our homes, like destruction of property, it becomes, it's just or only a vase, just or only a wall, an irreplaceable family heirloom that belonged to the foster parents, so don't worry about it. Besides, they get paid, which is another subject in itself. We all acknowledge that trauma exists in some level in all of us, yet for children in care, it may present itself in various ways to lashing out and destroying property. Most of these children are not able to see intricate relationships and draw excellent conclusions that many of their peers can. These are the ones that we are in need of decent liability insurance coverage for. Let's face it, most homeowners' insurance, their deductible is more than $250. Raising the compensation for damage or destruction of child or adult damage in our homes should be raised to an increase from $250 to $1,000. That would be a nice place to start. When we open our doors to care for these children, we know there are no guarantees, yet we still just do it. We ask that we have a chance to have foster parents be put on a footing that is equal to others. Let's start with giving them that chance now. So when asked what do I think we should do, I just think that we should increase the amount from $250 to $1,000. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you for being here today and sharing with us the work that you do that many think is thankless. So we want to thank you.
Thank you.
You have any other testifiers?
No.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 1658? Okay. Any discussion from members? Representative Patterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Ms. Douglas for being a foster care mom. I was a guardian ad litem with Hennepin County, and you guys just save kids' lives every day.
Thank
so thank you. And I think it's a reasonable bill, and I support it.
All right, so there being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House File 1658 be recommended for re-referral to the Committees on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 1658 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you. Okay, we are waiting on... Okay, why don't we move to, what number is that? House File 1041, Representative Poston. You would like to pass that to the page, they can pass it out. Thank you, Paige.
Paige.
Catherine. Okay. So the chair moves House File 1041 to be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have the bill before the committee. Representative Poston, welcome to the committee. Would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for hearing House File 1041 today. House File 1041 requires health plans to include coverage for ectodermal dysplasia, including reconstructive breast surgery, prosthetic hair, and dental work. And with that short description and being aware that we're short on time, I'm going to hand it right over to my testifier.
All right. Thank you. Carl Nelson.
Hello. Hi. My name is Carl Nelson, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Poston. Thank you for having us here. I'm Carl Nelson. My wife, Nancy, and my daughter, Sammy, are over there. And I'm accompanied by Molly Gonzer. Oh, need help? And then her husband, Mike. So myself Sammy and Molly's daughter are affected by ectodermal dysplasia. It's a very rare skin condition. It's a congenital syndrome that is affected by the formation of hair, sweat glands, nails, breast tissue, and changes in teeth, dental changes. I know the pictures are worth 1,000 words, and in your packet, if you would, hopefully you'll have your packets now. In your packet on the right side, first of all, there's a thank you letter in there from Ava.
1 minute for the packages.
I'm sorry. Yep, I can wait for a second. Okay. It's okay. Don't worry about it.
Disregard the names on the package, guys. You get the wrong package.
Okay. Yep. So on the right side of the packet, there's a bunch of pictures. There's a slide presentation. In the interest of time, I'll just let you review some of those pictures of people who are affected by this condition. Okay. But the things that are typically affected are going to be the formation of hair, sweat glands, nails, breast tissue, and teeth. And so those pictures will show some of those, okay? There's also a thank you letter from Ava. The incidence of the syndrome is estimated to be about 3 in 10,000 births. And statistically, that would be about 20 children in Minnesota would be born each year with this condition. There are numerous subtypes and vary in severity. Some of them can cause hand deformities or syndactyly. Some cleft lip, cleft palate, which you may be more familiar with, that condition. Some have severe skin erosions where the skin will actually just slough off in areas because the epidermis doesn't hold together. Sammy and I are very lucky in that we have a milder form of this condition. Hannah, Molly's daughter, does struggle with the lack of sweating in addition, and so she does enjoy athletics, so that can be a challenge to regulate her body temperature. Sammy, Ava, and I don't have any breast tissue. For me, that's not that big of a deal. As you can tell, I lost my hair, and that started when I was in the sixth grade. All of us have significant dental challenges, and both with treatment plans as well as with the insurance companies to try to get our care. If you were in a car accident and you hit your chin on the steering wheel and fractured that and you dislodged teeth, your medical insurance company would cover restoration of your care of your teeth, including dental implants and dentures. If you had a mastectomy for treatment of the after having breast cancer and you have reconstruction done, that breast reconstruction is covered. However, if you're born with it, you have a congenital anomaly and you don't have adequate teeth, and your dental care is not often covered by medical insurance because they think it's a dental problem. I was born with only a few teeth, and I had dentures at the age of 5. I needed teeth for speech development, for chewing, to minimize bone reabsorption, and to help me fit in with other kids. As I grew up, my bones matured, my teeth were not very good anchors, and I had few options. I decided to pursue dental implants at the University of Minnesota. As with many kids, this move involves bone grafting to create strong and healthy sites for the implants. Find in your packet, on the left side, my pantogram. So I have 10 implants in here, bionic. This treatment plan is widely recognized as the standard of practice for individuals like myself. And I have also included an estimate for the new implants, which is about $32,000, and an estimate for new uppers and lower dentures, which add up to about $40,000. That's my case. Everyone is different. But this would be out-of-pocket expense, and the majority of the families that are affected by this can't afford this type of treatment for something that is clearly medical. It's clearly related to a medical condition. Medical insurance companies say that the work is a dental problem, and they have exclusions in their policies. Dental insurance companies say it's cosmetic, and they have low coverage caps, maybe $2,000. That would maybe cover the bottom part of one implant. And we are caught in the middle, and we need your help because we're a small community. We don't have a big voice, but we are working on that. In reviewing Minnesota statutes, I'd like you to maybe pull out the bill, a copy of the bill if you have that. But in reviewing Minnesota statutes, Representative Poston and I have identified areas of improvement to help protect people with ectodermal dysplasias. The first section is intended to ensure that affected people who are missing breast tissue can seek reconstruction of their breasts at any point in their life, and this shouldn't be limited to be a dependent. For me, the lack of breast has not been a big deal, but this will be a big deal for Sammy and for Ava, who is in your packet. The second section addresses hair prosthetics and for people with ectodermal dysplasia who lost their hair. My family struggled with getting coverage for a wig for me when I started wearing that in the eighth grade, and we fought and fought and fought to get some of that. I didn't want to be wearing a wig, I can tell you that. It was a tough time. But I had to, partially because I had bald spots and some scarring. So, but it was a red step for me, and so I want to make sure everybody else can have that opportunity if they need it. So my parents were denied coverage, as I said, and right now in the Minnesota statute, it only specifies alopecia areata. So if you have alopecia from another condition, you're kind of not included. So I'd like to extend that to include ectodermal dysplasia. Section 3 is a new statute which outlines the insurance coverage requirements for people with ectodermal dysplasia, specifically dental restorations, as a result of this congenital anomaly. This would include dental implants, bone grafting to create a healthy space, orthodontia, and prosthodontics. In addition, routine maintenance should be included, such as cleanings. The benefit should be from the moment of birth with no age limitation, as many times you can't put implants in until the bone is set. Until it's mature, we can't do it younger. And so that is when the major expense occurs, as I showed from my pantogram. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to thank you again for listening to me today. Please consider working with Representative Poston and Representative Patty Acorn to make some legislative changes so we don't have to fight for every tooth, every strand of hair, and every breast. There are many aspects of this condition that we can't fix, but we can address those. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for being here and testifying and sharing your story. Thank you. To the next testifier, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, I'm Molly Gonzer, and Madam Chair and your committee, thank you for listening to us today. I have three daughters. All three are carriers of ectodermal dysplasia. My twin daughters are both affected by it. One is more serious than the other. This is a very personal, emotional situation for my family. My one daughter, if you can imagine, they're 22 years old right now, so we've been through a lot. And Carl's family and another family that was with us a few weeks ago, their kids are young and just starting out with this dilemma. We've been through the ringer with this, with insurance companies. We've been told it's been cosmetic, and my daughter's been to the University of Minnesota to get dentures. She had dentures all through grade school. You can imagine getting ready for school in the morning, and part of the routine of getting ready is to tell her to go get her teeth in. And she'd have her little dentures, and she'd have her Polident, and she'd rub her gums and dry them off and squirt the Polident and put her teeth in. And then the whole time I'm watching her, I've been told in my head, this is cosmetic. No coverage for these. And she comes down to eat breakfast, and I'm trying to hurry the other kids along, and she's eating cereal, and then her teeth come loose, and I tell her, you know, you have to go redo them. She goes, pops them out, cleans them out, dries her gums off, puts the Polident back in, and she puts her teeth back in, and off to school she goes. And during her school day, her teeth come loose. She has to go in the nurse's office, goes in. She does this routine multiple times a day. As I'm fighting insurance for coverage, and I keep being told this is cosmetic. She has no bottom teeth. She's never had bottom teeth. Her all gums, and I'm told it's cosmetic. As she ages, we go through high school. She refuses to wear dentures. She just wants to go without because they're a pain. So she hides her teeth. She doesn't like to smile. We get to the point where we look into implants, and I'm told that they're cosmetic. So now we're looking at over $150,000 worth of work to get implants done. And my other twin has to have bone grafting. She has some missing teeth due to ectodermal dysplasia. She has about $50,000 worth of work to get done. So in total, we have over $200,000. And I'm told it's cosmetic. We have doctor's letters. We have
our pediatrician, our dentist, our orthodontist in support that this is medically necessary. Her jawbone didn't grow correctly because she never had teeth, so she had a bone grafting done, and we are told repeatedly that this is due, that this is cosmetic. It's not medically needed. So we have surgeons ready to go. I keep being told by the surgeons, we have a treatment plan ready to go. We need to get this done. Let's go. And if you can imagine your kids ask you, when can I get my next iPhone, Mom, or when can I get the next Xbox, Dad? I get texts from my kids saying, when can I get my teeth? And I sit here and say, we keep fighting. My husband and I am remarried. He has stepped in to be an amazing dad to these kids, and we are now looking at considering selling our home to help pay for these teeth. We don't know where to go. We don't know where to look. We don't know what to do. So we're coming to you begging and pleading for health insurance. This is the genetic condition that these kids are born with, and my kids now, it's an X-linked genetic condition. Now my kids can pass this on to either a son or daughter, and they now have said to me that they're scared to death to have children because they don't want to go through what we've been through because of teeth. So I appreciate you listening to us today. I'm one of many set of parents that are going through this just to have to learn hoping to learn how we can pay for teeth for our kids. So thanks for listening to us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And again, thank you for being here and sharing your story and of course, educating us.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1041? Members, you have any questions? Okay. Representative Evans?
I apologize. I'm talking a lot today. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. I am incredibly empathetic to both of your families, and thank you for being here. I'm also, we had yesterday somebody come here and talk about their families are being infected by pandas and how insurance companies are not covering that as well, and I am sorry. I just, Representative, wanted to know, supportive of your bill. But also, are you working with Congress to make sure that we're addressing it on that level, too? Because we can only impact so much here. So I'm curious as to your efforts there, and I would like to work with you outside of this, too, to help.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. And, yes, we are working with the Congress.
Great. Okay, there being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion.
Madam Chair, can I just make a couple of comments real quick?
Yes, please.
You know, first of all, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I really don't believe a person born with this condition should be denied health care. It just doesn't make sense. These families should not be saving for dental care. They should be saving for their children's education, and they should be saving for their retirements. They shouldn't be mortgaging their homes to take care of dental care. We can't fix everything that this condition may cause a person to have, but the things we can fix are in this bill. So I really appreciate you hearing it, and I appreciate your support. And with that, thank you.
And with that, the chair renews her motion that House File 1041 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 1041 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So we're going to move to House File 785, Representative Ross. So the chair moves House File 785 and recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Members, we have the bill before us. Representative Zerwas, welcome back to the committee. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In interest of the committee's time, my testifier and I will be extremely expeditious. House File 785 was heard last year and was part of this committee's, the Finance Committee's supplemental budget bill and part of the larger supplemental budget bill. It is the Minnesota Board of Dentistry technical bill, and what it does is it creates an emeritus form of licensure, an emeritus inactive and emeritus active, which allows a practicing dentist who is set to retire. Right now, what ends up happening is it shows that their license is terminated, and after a full proud career as a dentist, if someone then goes to the Board of Dentistry website, it says that your license has been voluntarily terminated. It kind of ends your career with not the best light, and so this provides two options for dentists that are reaching the end of their career. If their intention is to retire, to stop practicing, to no longer do dental work, they can pay a one-time fee and be an they can be licensed as an emeritus dentist, but inactive. If the dental professional, as they retire, hopes to, which I think is a great idea, hopes to continue to do perhaps some volunteer work or work in the community, this allows them to apply for an emeritus active licensure, which allows them to keep remain a licensed dental provider in the state of Minnesota, but it reduces their fee significantly because all of their work would be done on a pro bono or voluntary basis. And that's the gist of the bill, Madam Chair. And I do have someone available from the Board of Dentistry here for questions or some brief comments.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and who you are and proceed with your
time. Sure. I'm Bridget Anderson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Dentistry. Madam Chair and members, thank you. I just wanted to add, you provided a wonderful overview, so I really am here for questions. But I did want to add that we did have 311 practitioners terminate last year, and that is among the dentists and allied professionals. So I do want to highlight that this bill would also be available to allied dental professionals for the pro bono and also for the consulting portion of that bill. All right. So I'm here to answer any questions that you may have. We wanted to keep it short and sweet, so hopefully you answered
a lot of the same. Does anyone in the audience would like to testify on House File 785? Members have any questions? All right. There have been no further discussion. The chair renews her motion that House File 785 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails and House File 785 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we're going to move to House File 1883, Representative Contenza. You're going to just correct me. Watoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gatiza Watoon.
All right. So the chair moves that House File 1883 be recommended for placement on the general register. Members, this bill has been re-referred to us from the Committee on Education Policy due to the language found in Section 2. We will only be considering that part of the bill in our hearing today. While we have an author's amendment filed for this bill, as well as an amendment from a committee member, they are both exclusive to Section 1, which falls outside of the purview of this committee. So neither amendment will be considered today. And I understand that the author of the bill and the author of the amendment has spoken about making those changes to the legislation in another venue. Are we correct? Okay. So with that, we have the bill before the committee. Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please give us a brief overview of the bill in Section 2.
Yes, absolutely. So we're specific to Section 2, hoping to establish a reporting process for children who are in the foster care system and when they're first enrolled in the foster care system, as well as any subsequent placements in new foster homes, just to ensure that they are being enrolled in a new school district if they are changing school districts due to that placement. So
essentially, this is information that the social workers already have. It's just not reported at this time, and so we're just hopeful to keep track of how many times this is going beyond the 7-school-day limit, and if it's happening on a frequent basis, then, you know, then we'll maybe be able to take future action on that. So I would be happy to introduce my testifier, Wong Murphy, who is the Executive Director of Foster Advocates.
Welcome to the committee. Please reintroduce yourself just for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Wong Murphy, and I'm the Executive Director of Foster Advocates. It's my honor to be speaking before you today. So I will keep things brief, and I will try to be the first person who says that and then actually does that. So I experienced the foster care system, and I think that people who have experienced the foster care system should have a say in what happens to them, and that's why we do this work. However, one of the worst facts about foster care is not the abysmal data that many of us are aware of, and Chair, that I know you are deeply aware of, is that there's actually very little data that we share with other departments that allows them to do their work effectively. A good parent talks to the other parent. A good parent asks how their kid is doing in school. When the state is your parents, then they should talk to each other. They should know how each other is doing. So what we are asking is that, you know, to uphold the adage that if we measure what we value, then right now we don't measure how our, and we don't value how our foster youth do in our schools. I think we can change that, and we can change that today. By changing the requirements, that data that social workers already have is shared with the Department of Education and included in the DHS's report to make sure that we know if kids are missing significant amounts of school who enter foster care, they're already dealing with such significant challenges, we should have the data so that we can speak more with more authority on that and address challenges. So thank you.
Thank you so much for being here and testifying. Is there anyone else in the audience would like to testify on House File 1883? Any discussion from members? Representative Pearson.
Well, again, it was deemed necessary to come to this committee, so it begs the question again why Section 2, the change in Section 2. I'm just curious. I'm not familiar with Section 128.21. What is that change actually creating as it pertains to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee? I understand the report, but that's currently required. So is this change actually affecting what's going on in Health and Human Services?
Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Pearson. As I understand it, the report is currently required, but this piece of data is not being collected. I believe that's why we were directed to this committee.
Representative Pearson? And so what we're asking is that kids are moving from home to home, from placement to placement, that they are required to be in the school within, I think, a 7-day time period. Is that really happening? And we would beg to say maybe not. And so we want to collect that. Thank you for the bill. It's a great bill.
Yes, absolutely.
And the bill is asking the department to collect that data.
Thank you for your time, Madam Chair. Members, if there's any other questions, I'm happy to stay. I am a current licensed foster parent in Hennepin County. My children came home to me over the summer break, so I had plenty of time to get everything sorted and all the materials from their previous district before we had to register them for the 2018-2019 school year, but not all foster parents have that advantage of having those summer months to do that, and so we just want to make sure that that this data is being tracked, and if they need additional assistance in making the registration process smoother, that we can provide that in the future. I appreciate your support. Thank you.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am the one with the amendment, and I guess I would just like to say, even though we're not discussing the first part of it, my concern was that whether a student was assigned to a public school, private school, or home school, that they had that opportunity. Obviously, Representative Watoon and I discussed the fact that you wouldn't send a child to a home school if they were removed from that parent. But there are my concern was making sure that those children had every best opportunity that the foster parents deemed so that that child was educated appropriately and depending on their situation. So.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So there being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House File 1883 be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 1883 is recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you so much for being patient. I know you're moving back and forth between this and Commerce.
Yes, I'm just glad that you guys aren't meeting in the Capitol today. I certainly got my steps.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
Okay, so what we're going to do is recess, and we're going to come back to this room around 6:45, maybe. And if it happens before that, just keep your eyes on your emails. But other than that, we're going to recess until 6:45. Thank you so much.
Call the health committee for division for health and human services back to order. Representative Edelson, would you move your bill?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I'd like to move. Hold on, where is it going? Move House File 2306 to be recommended for to go to the general registrar.
To your bill.
And then, Chair, I would also like to move the A19 amendment.
Representative Edelson moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment?
19.
The A19 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Hearing none. All those in favor of adoption of the A19-0171 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Is approved. To your bill as amended. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair. Chair members, this is the DHS policy bill. There are two articles, one related to housing support program and one related to mental health and substance use. Matt Burdick from DHS is here to walk us through the bill.
Good afternoon to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape, and you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Matt Burdick, Legislative Director for Healthcare, Behavioral Health, and Housing at the Department of Human Services. I'll try to move through this as quickly as I can, and if I can hit the two-minute mark, it'll certainly be a record. So as Representative Edelson noted, the first article here relates to the housing support program, and so I'll walk through section by section and then perhaps take questions after we go through this. So section one is clarifying and really being intentional about making sure that when a person is receiving services in a housing support setting, that those services are tied to their individual statement of need, trying to make sure that we have a formal connection between what a person needs and what services they are getting. Section two is clarifying the definition of supportive housing. And supportive housing refers to a housing setting where someone has their own lease in the community. And we are trying to streamline the process for authorizing these settings. And by doing so, removing the requirement that they need to have a registration, but making sure that there's an on-site assessment of the apartment to make sure that it is up to code, et cetera. Moving on to Section 3, this simply clarifies that someone cannot be both receiving the housing support room and board as well as another rental subsidy. And this is currently our expectation. We're just trying to clarify that in the statute. Section 4 is, again, about the clarification of the supportive housing definition. Section 5 clarifies that a provider cannot restrict the amount of hours a person chooses to work when they're in a housing support setting. And this is intended to maximize a person's independence. Section 6 is, again, getting back to that idea of connecting the services someone's received with what their need is. And then Section 7 is back to the employment issue I referenced before. The Section 8 clarifies the role. Currently, people are allowed to be absent from a housing support setting due to illness or crisis. Currently, the statute reads that that must be approved. We are changing that to clarify that we're simply tracking those hours and not putting the burden on the counties to note when someone's crisis justifies their being absent. And then the final piece, this repealer, repeals a section of law that had some limitations on the rate someone could receive in a housing support setting. So if they were being charged a rate lower than the standard housing support rate, we'd want to allow that to happen if that person was at that level. So that is the housing section. I'll stop there. And if not.
All right. Thank you so much. Does anyone else who?
Well, and,
so, okay. Should we do Matt, Tim? Members, do you have any questions? All right, wonderful.
Great, and then I'll move on to Article 2, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much.
So Article 2, the bulk of this article relates to our substance use disorder licensure chapter, Chapter 245G. We've been working closely with the provider community and the different provider associations and are going to continue to do more work to make sure that by the time this crosses the finish line, we're in a place of mutual comfort with these sections. The goal of these changes is to make sure that the statute is clear for both our licensing area and our policy area, as well as for providers, so that we've got objective standards that everyone understands and can meet. So the first seven sections are adding additional definitions, again, trying to get at that concept of clarity and making sure that we're all on the same page about what the various terms in our licensure statute mean. Section 8 is attempting to clarify the activities and the timing for when a person enters treatment. This is really trying to get at the idea that a person might come in, say, at 11:59, and when does that day of treatment begin? Trying to provide some flexibility and some kind of order to how that happens, recognizing that people don't enter treatment in a linear or sometimes clean fashion, if you will. Section 9 clarifies both the timing and the content of what is, goes into a comprehensive assessment. The comprehensive assessment is used to really inform what the person's level of need is and inform their future treatment planning. Section 10 is, again, clarifying the timing of when different activities have to happen when a person enters treatment, when their individual treatment plan has to be developed, what constitutes it being complete, and things of that nature. Section 11 is a continuation of what goes into those plans. Section 12, and this is actually adjusted in the amendment, clarifies the timing of when a discharge summary has to be complete, as well as indicates that when a client requests their own discharge summary, that that is something that is made available to them after they've left treatment, if that's helpful to inform their next treatment provider when they are entering the next stage of treatment. Section 13 is really just clarifying what services are provided and distinguishing residential treatment from non-residential treatment and trying to clean up the statute a little bit from when this first came to be. We're also clarifying the role of peer recovery supports and sort of reordering the statute to align with how our expectations. The next section I'll just draw people's attention to is Section 15. This is also substantively changed by the amendment. This is something that I think members have heard about from the provider community. When we passed this law, there was a kind of a strong limitation that said group treatment settings could be only limited to 16 clients. And we heard strongly from the provider community that, well, that made good sense for what we think about as traditional counseling groups. That did not make sense for other group activities, lectures, for instance, or other a house meeting, things that might actually benefit from having a larger staff-to-client ratio. And so in the amendment is some language that we've been working on with the provider community, continue to work on with the provider community around that issue of the staff-to-client ratio for those non-group treatment settings and something that we're working to come to a mutual resolution around. Section 17, related to recovery peer qualifications, as you can see, the language was stricken that said that a certification body approved by the commissioner, we are adding the bodies that would be approved. This is in alignment with what's in our state plan. Section 18 is just some clarifying language, adding in some cross-references. And in the interest of time, I will skip ahead. Sections 25 through 33 relate to standards in our opioid treatment programs. And this is, again, a lot of cleanup language and language we've worked out with the providers to make sure that we've got clear expectations for all involved. The two sections I do also want to call out that are not related to the substance use disorder licensure statutes and these various cleanups are sections 37 and section 38. These relate to our new psychiatric residential treatment facility benefit. What these do are two clarifying changes. One is being clear that medical necessity reviews do not need to be conducted by DHS's medical review agent when a person is enrolled in managed care. Managed care organizations do their own medical necessity reviews. And Section 38 clarifies the process for billing for services that the facility itself is not providing. So if they're working in collaboration with an outside provider, clarifying that either the facility or that outside provider can submit the bill. And this is in alignment with our agreement with the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services.
All right, members, any other questions? Okay, so our next...
Madam Chair, Tim Walsh, I believe, is the next testifier.
Yes.
Minnesota Adult Teen Challenge.
Hello and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and who you're with and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tim Walsh, and I'm a chair of the Government Affairs Committee for March, and I'm also a VP at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. Appreciate to hear from DHS that this is not a finished product, that it's a work in process. DHS has been working with the provider community, with March and other stakeholders, to be very responsive to our concerns about these changes, and they have been responsive to our input. They have also limited the changes as we review the bill. They've limited changes to necessary adjustments to the bill and any technical fixes that are necessary. And also just want to echo that DHS is going to be working with March and other stakeholders to continue to refine and improve the bill. And we're going to be meeting on Monday to do a complete review to make suggestions or input to DHS on that. So we appreciate that we're going to continue to provide input and also appreciative that they've provided us many opportunities to do so.
Thank you so much for your time.
Madam Chair, the next testifier, Chuck Rice, actually will not be testifying this evening.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Edison. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify? Okay. Members, any further questions? Representative Fisher.
Thank you. I've got one question, and I might have missed it as we're going through everything quickly. It'd probably be toward the person from the department, Mr. Burdick. As I'm reviewing the changes that we went through quickly and getting the feel from the housing, is this kind of trying to address the problem that some of the treatment addiction facilities have had with where they've got very short-term stays where people are in like for 4 or 5 days and move out, or what is happening through here? I heard at one time there was issues with short-term stays not getting reimbursed. Is this a different issue that's coming up that's driving this?
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, I'm not familiar with the specific issue that you're addressing. Really, the changes in here are largely technical. The one area where I talked about, I think, timely access was really around our definition of supportive housing, and that was to make sure that we can authorize those settings more quickly, but I'm not sure if that's responsive to the specific concerns that you have been hearing from providers.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's kind of where it's getting at is I know that before that some of the writers were mentioning that sometimes people are in for very short stays and that to get through the process, by the time they got through the process, the people were gone and they weren't able to get reimbursed.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Burdick.
Representative Fisher, so this does not deal with the process of actually getting enrolled in housing support. I would mention that the governor's budget actually has a provision that would provide a period of presumptive eligibility for housing support for people leaving residential treatment, both mental health and substance use, which I believe would get at the very issue that you're talking about.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Okay. There have been no further discussions. Representative Fisher, Edison, renews her motion that House File 3306, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails and House File 2306, as amended, is recommended for placement on the general register. So, Representative Edison, Representative, we're going to swap real quick, and I'm going to present my bill, and then we're going to bring you back. Thank you.
Chair Moran, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move that House File 2334 be recommended for placement on the General Register.
We have the bill before the committee. Chair Moran, I understand you have an author's amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Chair Moran moves the A1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Moran, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, this is a department bill, a DHS bill. I am happy to carry it as a co-author, but what I'm going to do is pass it over to Mr. Burdick so he can go through the bill.
Mr. Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Matt Burdick with the Department of Human Services. This bill, as Representative Moran indicated, is a DHS policy bill. This relates to our health care area, and I'll walk through the bill and happy to entertain any questions members have. The first piece of this bill, and you'll see this peppered throughout the bill, is simply moving the statutory structure related to the health care home out of DHS statute and into the Department of Health statute. The Department of Health is actually responsible for the certification of health care homes, but the language has lived in the Medicaid chapter of law, and so much of what you'll see in this bill is moving that section of law into 62U, which is under the purview of the Department of Health. And so that would take up sections 1 and 2. Section 3 was something that was part of the department's policy bill in 2017. This relates to our state's medical review team. The state medical review team, otherwise known as SMRT, helps conduct disability determinations on behalf of the Social Security Administration to help people who may be eligible for medical assistance on the basis of a disability. Several years ago, we changed the process for this. Previously, counties were responsible for collecting all of the person's medical records and submitting that to the state. This required a lot of back and forth with providers, created a lot of burden for our county partners. So the state has actually moved to having counties refer clients to us, and then the DHS actually works directly with the providers to collect the necessary medical information to make that disability determination. And so this statute change is trying to clarify the process and the role of the counties. Section 4 was actually something that was part of the omnibus bill last session. What this does is clarifies the linkage between Medicare certification for certain providers who primarily serve a pediatric population. The statute currently requires that rehabilitation providers be enrolled with Medicare in order to be enrolled with medical assistance. Unfortunately, what has happened is that if a provider is not billing Medicare, Medicare is disenrolling those providers. And so what this would do is allow us to do the exact same review that we would be doing for a Medicare certification without requiring them to actually go through and get that for Medicare, having the circumstances where they're constantly being disenrolled for a lack of billing Medicare. And I believe you'll have a testifier speaking more to the importance of this topic after I'm done here. Section 5 has actually been eliminated with the author's amendment. There's several sections within this bill that related to an advisory council. Given tight committee deadlines, we are going to revisit that topic next year and save a committee stop for this bill. Section 6 is the beginning of a number of sections you'll see where we're really cleaning up the statute to align with federal law as it relates to health care eligibility. There's a lot of cleanup that has to have been done since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, and so we're trying to make sure that our state statutes are clear and so that enrollees, county workers, other people are really clear about what the rules of the road are. And so Section 6 is the first of those changes. Section 7 continues that, as does Section 8. Section 9 is a continuation of that as well. Section 10 relates to a provision that was part of the budget in 2017. Federal law requires us to establish a new asset verification system as part of eligibility determinations for people who have an asset test under medical assistance. This is laying out the process for how that will work so that it's clear for enrollees and others how that will be administered. And the legislature appropriated DHS funding to contract with a vendor in 2017, and we are engaging in that process now. Section 11 lays out the process and policy around periodic data matching to be clear about the responsibilities of an enrollee when they have been found to have a discrepancy and when their
when their eligibility can resume. Section 12 is a continuation of aligning our state statute with our federal eligibility laws. Section 13 is intended to clarify both state and federal under both state and federal law that the medical assistance program cannot pay for housing, and this has just been an issue that has come to our attention, so we want to make sure the state law is clear. Section 14 clarifies, again, under federal law, that hospitals performing transplants must have a Medicare certification, and that was something that there was some question about. The statute was a little bit unclear, and so we want to make that clear that pursuant to federal law, these hospitals must receive a Medicare certification. Section 15 has been eliminated from the bill, as has Section 16 and 17. Section 18 is a cross-reference related to the organ transplant and Medicare certification that I referenced earlier. Sections 19 and 20 have been removed from the bill. And then Section 21 is a continuation of the movement of the healthcare home statutes into the Department of Health section of law and correcting cross-references. And Section 22 is a continuation of that as well, as is Section 23. Section 24 simply addresses a drafting error. When we changed our reimbursement structure for critical access hospitals, the law had an incorrect date as to when that took effect. This has already been implemented. We are correcting the statute to reflect and correct that drafting error. Section 25 clarifies that behavioral health home services are not part of the Minnesota Care benefit set. When we moved Minnesota Care to a basic health care program, we needed to align where there are certain Medicaid-specific services that are not eligible to be covered under the BHP. This is not changing our existing policy. It's simply making sure that we're clear in alignment with our agreement with the federal government. Section 26 is cleaning up some outdated statute related to Minnesota Care premiums. The legislature several years ago codified our premium structure, and this is removing some outdated language. Section 27 is a reviser's instruction to complete the work of moving the healthcare home statute out of DHS statute and into the Department of Health statute. And then Section 28 is a repealer. Most of the repealer sections relate to items that I discussed previously. The one item I will call out is we have a grant program known as our Integrated Care for High-Risk Pregnant Women. The funding for that program is in our base budget, but the statutory direction on how that program is operated expires, and so we want to remove the expiration date since we imagine the legislature would want us to continue to expend those dollars in the way that you all have directed us. And that is the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Perdick. Is Abigail Vavra here? I hope I pronounced your name correctly. I apologize if I didn't. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Abigail Vavra. I am the Compliance Officer and Public Policy Analyst for Frazier, and I'm here tonight to let you know that this bill has a significant impact on the children that we serve. As Mr. Burdick mentioned earlier, we are often disenrolled from Medicare certification because our children are not Medicare eligible and we do not bill Medicare services. So voting on behalf of this bill this evening will help thousands of children. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Discussion from the committee. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Burdick or to Chair Moran, on Section 18 of the bill, on page 17 of the amendment, I note that under organ and tissue transplants, it says organ and tissue transplants are a covered service, and what was stricken is that it must be performed at a transplant center meeting United Network for Organ Sharing Criteria or a Medicare-approved organ transplant centers, but yet that same or somewhat similar criteria for stem cell or bone marrow transplants is contained or maintained. I'm just wondering the decision-making process around why that sentence was added.
Mr. Burdick.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I believe that section has to be read in conjunction with Section 14, where we clarify that inpatient hospital services are performed by a hospital holding a Medicare certification. What was confusing about the organ transplant sentence in particular that we were striking is that it implied that you could either have a Medicare certification or this meet this other standard, and that was not an option under federal law. I would have to get back to the committee about the language we're not amending here around the bone marrow transplants. I just don't know enough about that. But I'd be happy to follow up on that point.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Burdick, that answers half my question, but I'm just wondering, were organ and tissue transplants a covered service before we amended the language in the statute?
Mr. Burdick.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Burdick, thank you for your testimony. My question is, in Subdivision 2 regarding periodic data matching, I guess I'm curious to know, this D was added for basically the reinstatement of medical assistance once eligibility was terminated. Mr. Burdick, has that happened yet? Has eligibility been terminated based on periodic data matching?
Representative New, would you clarify which page you're referring to, please?
Page 12.
Thank you.
12.6 to 12.8 is the new section, is the new language in that section.
Mr. Burdick.
Madam Chair, Representative New, yes, we have implemented the periodic data matching system. It is now live. And I actually have some figures in front of me, and I'd be happy to share these with this committee, but we do have cases that have been closed due to either a discrepancy being found of someone not resolving that or someone being found to not be eligible through that process.
Representative
Nixon. Madam Chair, thank you. I guess I would be interested in some more information on that. When did the periodic data matching begin, and how is that working right now?
Mr. Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative New, we did a field test this summer and in collaboration with our county partners to make sure that the system was functional. And then the system has gone live as of late 2018, and they are now running monthly what we call batches, where a series of kind of cases are selected, analyzed against the system, and then where there's found to be a discrepancy, an enrollee receives a notice and has to respond to clarify if the information that we have in the system is not matching up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So right now it's not the periodic data matching is not happening with everyone. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Burdick.
Madam Chair, Representative New, I'm actually going to phone a friend here. I've got some of our healthcare eligibility experts in the room, and I'd like them to speak to some of the nuances of this.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Karen Giusto, DHS. The way that periodic data matching works is that the entire universe of enrollees, it's divided by 12 months. And so if I'm an MA enrollee, I have a renewal, which is in the 12-month anniversary of my eligibility, and my periodic data matching month is in month 6. And so for medical assistance, people may have periodic data matching. It's always 6 months after the month of application. So depending upon when they applied, they would fall into that calendar. So it's approximately 1/12 of the overall medical assistance population every month. And then for Minnesota Care, we have it spread across a shorter number of months because for Minnesota Care, all of our enrollees renew at the same time. And so we have a window where we don't run periodic data matching because it's renewal. And then we have the universe of Minnesota Care spread across, I believe it's 9 months of the year.
Representative New?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps in this phone a friend, do you have any data then on how that's going? I mean, this is specifically regarding eligibility termination. How is that going, and approximately how many people have had that eligibility terminated so far?
Ms. Giusto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I do. And we, as Mr. Burdick mentioned, we ran a field test in September. And then beyond that, we've started our batches. We've run three kind of cohorts And so in for our September field test, we started out with 64,901 enrollees who were in our initial selection. Of those, roughly 10%, 6,659, were flagged as having a discrepancy. That means that data that we received indicated that they may not be eligible. And then of that cohort, we canceled medical assistance coverage for 2,340. And so that was our initial field test. We have one complete cycle beyond that, and that was for February of 2019. In that cohort, we started out with 51,954 MA enrollees who were selected for the process. Of that, again, it was about 10%, 5,192 were identified as having discrepancies. And from that, 2,349, their medical assistance was closed at the end of February.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you. That's very detailed information. I appreciate that. Presumably, then, those who were not canceled were able to provide the information to show eligibility in that time frame?
Ms. Giusto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, yes.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing there being no further discussion, Chair Moran renews her motion that House File 2334, as amended, be recommended for placement on the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 2334 is amended as recommended for placement on the General Register.
Thank you.
Right. Representative Edelson, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would. Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 2185. Be recommended for placement on the General Register.
We have the bill before the committee. Representative Edelson, I understand you have an author's amendment.
I do, Madam Chair. I'd like to move that amendment.
Representative Edelson moves the DE-11 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Edelson, please present your bill.
Madam Chair and members, this is the Disability Service Policy Bill, and I'm going to go ahead and let Heidi from DHS go ahead and explain all the bill to you.
Ms. Hamilton, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Hamilton. I'm the Legislative Director for Disability Services, Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services, and Continuing Care for Older Adults at the Department of Human Services. I'm going to walk through the bill, not section by section, by topic by topic. You should have a handout which outlines the topics that are in the bill. And then I'm happy to answer questions as you would like me to take them. The first section is related to removing outdated language from the corporate foster care moratorium statute.
Madam Chair, I apologize. I don't know that we have that handout. Thank you. Sorry about that.
Sorry. Madam Chair, it looks like this.
It's being passed around.
Yeah, it's being passed out.
Very good. Okay, Ms. Hamilton, I think you can proceed.
All right, I'm sorry about that. So Section 1 removes outdated language from the corporate foster care moratorium. When the corporate foster care moratorium was passed in 2009, the department was working with PCA providers who were running group homes to help them become appropriately licensed most of the time as foster care. And so the legislature wanted to allow that process to continue to happen, and so those homes could convert to corporate foster care settings. Those settings have all been now converted, and it's been this exception hasn't been used for several years, and so we're just removing that language from the statute. Next, sections 2, 4 through 7, and 17 relate to aligning the 245D statute, which is our licensure statute, with what is included in the home and community-based services waiver plans. Mm-hmm. Services were added to provide consistency across the waiver programs. The behavioral services were changed to be called positive support services, which better describes the purpose of the service. And there's also language that updates the provider qualifications to align with what's in the federally approved waiver plans. Section 3 relates to appropriate oversight of services. In 2014, the legislature passed a revision to 245D that amended the service plan requirements for all 245D intensive in-home support services. That change was intended to only apply to independent living skills training service, so we've worked with the stakeholders to narrow that exemption and to reinstate the service planning requirements for the other in-home support services. Sections 8 and 24 relate to foster care and PCA for sibling groups. So under current law, when a child requires PCA services and they're also living in a foster care home, they cannot live in a home with more than four children, even if they have sibling groups that make the capacity more than four children. And so this is just changing the law to allow children to remain with their sibling groups and to receive both foster care and their needed PCA services. Next, sections 9 through 16 are related to MIN choices efficiencies. At the direction of the legislature, DHS worked with lead agencies to identify efficiencies in the MIN Choices assessment process. MIN Choices is an assessment tool that determines eligibility across several home and community-based programs at the same time, so people don't have to receive separate assessments for each program. We were able to work with the lead agencies to identify several ways to make the process more efficient, including allowing a certified assessor to complete a PCA assessment during the transition period to MIN Choices, not requiring MIN Choices to determine eligibility for some grant programs and home care nursing, clarifying that MIN Choices is used to gain access to Rule 185 case management, clarifying timelines, allowing the legal representative to give input remotely, and clarifying when a provider can submit written documentation for an assessment. Section 18 relates to the disability waiver rate system exception process, and this clarifies the existing practice and aligns existing practice with what's in statute. The banding transition period is ending December 31st of 2019, and so we want to make sure to clean up that language as providers who are no longer banded become eligible to receive exceptions. Next, sections 19 through 32 and 34 relate to community-first services and supports. When this service is implemented, it will replace the PCA program and the consumer support grant. This proposed language is necessary for the Community First Services and Supports Program to function effectively upon implementation and to comply with the agreement between the Department of Human Services and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The proposal amends statute to create consistent service delivery across managed care and fee-for-service. It defines the roles and responsibilities of the participant representative, and it develops quality standards for providers and Community First Services and Supports workers. There's also language that requires us to work with the reviser and with nonpartisan staff to address cross-reference issues with removing PCA from statute. And then finally, Section 33 relates to updating terminology and some technical changes. The disability linkage line has now been changed to be called the Disability Hub, and so we want to update that in statute. As well as the developmental disabilities waiver throughout statute is sometimes referred to as the developmental disability waiver, and so we want to make sure to be able to update that. I'm happy to stand for questions that anybody has about what's in the policy bill.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Discussion from the committee. Representative Albright.
So thank you for either the author or more presumably for the testifier. Page 54 of the DE under revisor instructions, the language says shall prepare legislation for the 2020 legislative session to repeal laws governing the Consumer Support Grant Program and Personal Care Assistance Program and Minnesota statutes. Am I missing something? That doesn't sound altogether really a good, you know, good.
Ms. Hamilton.
Ms. Chair, Representative Albright, this is repealing PCA and Consumer Support Grant references in statute in order to replace it with references to Community First Services and Supports, because that's the program that will be replacing the PCA program.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions? All right. There being no further discussion, Representative Edelson renews her motion that House File 2185 as amended be recommended for placement on the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 2185 as amended is recommended for placement on the General Register. We will reconvene Friday at 9 a.m. in this room, and we are adjourned.